Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you on Wednesday evening, August 18th, 2010. It is now 7.01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. You can send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website. That's going to be our guest this evening, by the way, to sutton-associates.net. In his newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. In fact, Andy is on the line now, I believe. Let's get him on the line. Let's get the show going. Good evening. Is that you, Andy?
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well.
You've been busy, I bet, lately.
I've been very busy. It's nice to take a break and chat with you.
Okay, good. Consider this a respite from everything that's been going on. Well, last month we had you on the program. We intend to hopefully have you, if you'd like, on the third Wednesday of every month from now until maybe the year. I think what our contract runs out about 2042, right, Andy? Somewhere around there.
Yeah, something like that. I know you mentioned, possibly exhuming a body or something like your email.
Folks, I have to tell
you, I look forward to being on here, so that's good.
Yeah, I have to tell everyone what you meant by that. I sent Andy an email, and I enjoy his newsletters because they're so insightful. And they're easy to understand, and they're not gobbledygook hype. I mean, they're just raw numbers and it's straight talk. And I sent an email to Andy saying that, you know, this is a warning. If you would die, I'm going to exhume your body so you can continue your monthly newsletter. Then we'll put you back in the ground. Well, I hope you took that as a compliment, you know, and nothing else
I,
but
I
that.
I did. I figured, well, there's two ways I can look at this, so I'm going to take it the good way.
Okay. Well, Andy, I think I'd like to start. There's a lot of things I'd like to talk about because I read your newsletter in fine detail, and I always do. I print the whole thing out, and I go to the coffee shop, and I sit there in my little corner, and I read the whole thing. Since last month, when we last discussed economic issues, has anything progressed? Can we say we are better off now than we were before in any areas? And what areas have we regressed? If you could just comment on that, please.
Well, that's a good question. I can tell you that as far as progressing, consumers did deleverage a little bit further in the most recent month. The consumer credit numbers did contract slightly. Credit card use, outstanding balances, I should say, was down significantly. So that's a good thing. People continue to deleverage. Of course, you know, when you listen to the mainstream press, you see this is a double-edged sword that we have. When consumers don't borrow and spend, that's viewed as bad for the economy because so much of the economy relies on consumption. And it's been fueled by debt for so many decades now that the mainstream press, you know, when consumer credit numbers go down or retail sales are flat or any of those kind of measures, everybody, you know, it's like you're at a funeral, to bring back the prior analogy there. So that was a good thing as far as moving forward, but it's a double-edged sword because if consumers aren't borrowing and spending, GDP is going to be sluggish. I mean, we could get a revision downward on second quarter GDP. It could be close to flat growth. I mean, it could be well within the margin of error for what the measurement is. I mean, they were talking about 2%, and now they're talking, well, maybe it was only, you know, 0.4 because of the trade imbalance or trade deficit swelled, so that's not good. But that's in the face of the dollar becoming weaker, so that's usually export-friendly, but our exports were down significantly last month. So, you know, the consumer credit is good. That was nice to see. But some of these other measures, the jobs numbers are still not, there's nothing there. I mean, there's been a lot of money spent, well over $1 trillion just in direct stimulus, and it's not really having much of a benefit on jobs outside of the census. And I don't even really count that because it's make work. It doesn't produce anything.
Right.
What does it produce?
Right.
You know, the census doesn't, it doesn't pay for itself. So I really don't even give that too much credibility in turn. I mean, yeah, it paid some people's mortgages for a couple of months, and it bought some groceries and that kind of thing, but it's not sustainable. And it seems that's where we're at, Joe. Now, you've got a situation where most of Washington just seems to say, well, we'll just keep stimulating. And every time the economy slows, we'll just borrow another trillion or $2 trillion, and we'll stimulate. We'll fix more roads and bridges. We'll take another census. Maybe we'll do the census every year.
Right.
You know, that seems to be where we're at. So philosophically, there's been no progress. They still haven't figured out that the government can't be all things to all people, the government can't create jobs, and the government cannot create economic prosperity. So, I mean, as far as the mindset goes, unfortunately, we're really no different than we were a month ago.
Yeah. Folks, just let me remind you, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. With us this evening, we have Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking about the economic conditions as they exist right now, and maybe can square us away as to where we need to go to protect ourselves. Andy, there's something I don't understand. The government spending is included in the GDP, which to me is an oxymoron in itself. But the government spends money, let's say, gives it to someone. That person then takes the money and spends it. Now they include that spending in the GDP. Do we not have a double dipping and a false double dipping, or am I looking at this incorrectly?
No, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You know, and I've written about this a number of times, and it's a real issue. Every time we get the quarterly GDP reading, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you know, gross domestic product was up 2.4% annualized based on last quarter's results. And they always report, Joe, an annualized number, and that is what is important also. So if you're looking at a 2.4% annualized pace, that means that they expected the quarter to be 0.6%. So
right.
You've got to keep that in mind also.
Right.
So on some of these measurements, they always report annualized figures because it makes it look bigger.
Yeah.
And I really believe that that's an intentional bias that's built into the methodology, but it even goes, Joe, a step further than what you said. Not only do they report government spending, now some government spending is legitimate, but what they also do is every dollar that the government borrows from a third party, from China or from OPEC nations or wherever, they borrow it, they spend it in the economy, that gets counted as if it was, you know, some, you know, from some surplus account that the government had. You know, say the government had a little, you know, for lack of a better term, a little fiscal cookie jar, and
right.
There was actually real savings in there.
Right.
They count a borrowed dollar spent in the economy the same as they would count a saved dollar spent in the economy, and that's totally fraudulent.
Right, right. Okay. I thought maybe I was just losing it because we always key on spending, and spending is not really the indicator of the health of an economy. That's the result of producing something, of being productive. We're not being we are productive in what we do, but not as much as we used to, but yet we expect the spending to outpace our productivity, and thus equals growth. And it shakes me up. I just can't get a handle on that, and no one seems to want to address that, at least in the mainstream media. Am I thinking incorrectly?
Well, no, I mean, you're right. The productivity versus spending, that whole paradigm is kind of like a rodent or a gerbil on one of those little wheels that you put them on
right.
in the cage, where the gerbil has to run faster and faster and faster to prevent itself from falling off the little wheel. That's kind of what we have with regards to productivity. You know, every time the productivity numbers come out, they always say, oh, the American worker is so much more productive and they're doing so much more for less. Well, yeah, that's because people are doing a lot of extra work for free because they don't want to lose jobs. I mean, it's not true in every case, but it's certainly true in a lot of cases. So, and it really underscores the point that I try to drive home in both the 2 cents newsletter and the paid subscription letter as well, is you really have to look at the methodologies and the institutional inherent biases of these reporting metrics, whether it's unemployment, retail sales, inflation, as measured by CPI, whatever the situation is. You really have to tear down the methodology and figure out what they're actually reporting or what they're not reporting, and then you get kind of get a better idea of what is going on there. And they don't talk about that in mainstream. But the productivity and savings thing, yes, that's another broken, I guess you'd call it an ideology of sorts, where, you know, mainstream government economists, they think that all you have to do is keep people spending faster than productivity, or, you know, that sort of thing, and then all of a sudden that's going to generate growth. And they're coming about it totally the wrong way.
Right. We have a couple people on the line. Let's see if this person has a question for you or a comment. 378. Hello. Good evening. Thank you for calling in. Your name, please.
Hi. My name is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
And I just got back from Michigan. I'm from Lansing, and I was in Lansing last week in the Detroit area. And it's such a sad story, and, you know, with so many people out of work and businesses boarded up and people losing their homes. And what in the world can help turn that around where they can actually start having jobs again and getting their lives back together?
Well, you know, Sarah, we only take difficult questions. That's just much too easy for this program. Only kidding. Believe me, only kidding. Would you like to tackle that, Andy? I certainly don't.
Sure. Sure. Sarah, first of all, thanks for calling in with your question. And it's a very good one. It's legitimate, and it's something that a lot of people really are wondering now. And it's not just Detroit. It's many other areas where we used to have factory and infrastructure. And really, the short answer is we need to start making more products here in America. And there seems to be, you know, something of a national pride movement that's going on, with people are becoming a little bit more self-conscious about buying things that are made here. But in so many instances, we just don't have choices. You know, you go into a Walmart or a Kmart or one of the Target, one of those places, try and find something that's made in America, it's very difficult. The short answer is we need to make more products here. The more difficult answer is, how are we going to make those products that can be priced competitively when you have people that are working in Asia for, you know, 50 cents a day? It's very difficult, you know, given the trade agreements that are in place, given, you know, our trade environment and our reliance on foreign infusions of capital to keep our economy going. It's difficult to say, hey, China, we're gonna put quotas and tariffs on all, you know, trinkets that you guys send over here. That's not going to work. You know, the same goes for a number of other nations because we depend on them so much. And this is kind of the hole that we've kind of pigeonholed ourselves into with regards to trade. We've given away so much of our national independence because we're relying on foreign oil, and that's been going on for years, and that's been hotly contested. We're dependent on that. It goes way beyond that, though. It's not just that. It's so many finished goods, capital goods, services. You know, if you go to a radiology place and have your x-ray taken, it could very well be read in India. So we've got all these different instances where those things could be done here. They should be done here. We have plenty of qualified people here that can do these jobs, but we have trade agreements, trade environment, and a financing environment that is really weighing against bringing a lot of these jobs back home in meaningful measure. So unfortunately, to get back to your question about Detroit, that's what it's going to take to make these areas flourish again and to bring them out of this depression that they're in. And unfortunately, we're so far off as far as getting the environment set up where we could cultivate a job-friendly and manufacturing-friendly environment here in America.
Andy, let me tag on something here. Is it such that we took advantage of the situation that we were in after World War II, where we were the only producing industrial economy in the world, a major economy in the world? So we were able to produce items at whatever the cost was. People had to buy them because they were unavailable anyplace else. Japan at the time was producing some stuff, but it was junk at the time. When Deming went over there and showed him how to make quality merchandise, which we ignored altogether, they started producing things that were of higher quality than they were over here. So things started to turn when we no longer had a monopoly. While we had the monopoly, our pay scale kept on rising exponentially, while the rest of the world stayed the same. So we became uncompetitive by virtue of our own success. Does that make any sense, or am I going down the wrong road?
No, you're absolutely right, and I think a lot of it comes back to the monetary system. You know, you mentioned the pay scales growing exponentially. That was happening because while we had status after World War II, what we did is we started these programs and all of this kind of thing, and we spent away the national savings account. We spent away our surpluses,
right.
And obviously, the Federal Reserve continued to devalue the dollar. You know, if you take even their own data, you take a look at it, and it shows a steady devaluation ever since they became in control of the money supply. You know, so you had that, and that drove up wages. And basically, we got so out of kilter with the rest of the world that once they figured out, in Japan, I'll use steel as an example. You know, Japan was in the ruins after World War II, but what they did is they built ultra-modern steel-producing facilities.
Right.
And our steel companies here, for the most part, didn't ever bother to modernize. So the Japanese could make it cheaper, they could make it quicker, and they took advantage of that.
Yeah.
Our companies couldn't compete.
Yeah. Sarah, are you still on the line, Sarah?
Yes, I am.
Sarah, I think a partial answer may be, and I'll let Andy chime in, is that we're going to have to be prepared to start working for less. We're going to have to become price competitive as well as quality competitive and all this other stuff. And not only with our ingenuity, but with working per hour. And I think we may wind up getting into a deflationary pay scale environment until we become more competitive. For example, China is all hacked off because they have closed thousands of factories in China. It's a little known fact. Thousands of factories have closed in China because Vietnam is producing those same goods at the same or better quality at a lower price. So you see what's happening around the world, and we can't exempt ourselves from it. We can't say, well, we'll exclude ourselves from the world economy. We'll just continue to do it our way, and that's unfortunate. It's going to be I think it's going to be a real tough road, Sarah. I don't think there's an easy answer. Andy, I'll give you the last word on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, but that's a very good point that you bring up, a deflationary wage environment, because, I mean, basically you've got a couple of different ways this thing can go. We can either work for less, and that's not going to fly really because of our price environment.
Right.
So basically, all else being the same, if we were to say, all right, everybody in America is going to work for, I don't know, I'm going to pick an arbitrary number, 25% less, say.
Right.
That basically, given everything else, you're going to have a substantial decrease in the living standard here.
Right.
And that's not something people really want to hear. The other end of this thing is we could say, all right, we are just not going to, we're going to try and apply pressure on China and some of these other countries. We're going to start tariffing their goods, and we're going to start putting quotas on them, and we're going to try and attack it from that side, and we'll deal with the fallout. You know, they might say, hey, all right, we're not going to buy any more treasuries. Well, then our government's going to have to stop spending so much money.
Right.
You know, so there's a couple different ways this could be attacked at. What I try to drill down to is where does the willpower lie in not only the political structure, but in, you know, the people, the populace. And I'm not seeing a lot of focus on these kinds of issues. I see a lot of, well, we're going to blame so-and-so because they have this particular position or because, you know, the other guy didn't do this, or it's more to me, Joe, about people right now than it is about the actual issues. And as long as the issues aren't even being discussed, we're a ways off from even starting to address any of this. That's just my opinion.
No, yeah, and you know, people and understand, Sarah. We basically are a nation at war, and probably will always be at war for one reason or another, justified or not. And even a nation that is at war, as we are experiencing a recessionary environment, which is very, very unusual. As I heard one person say, says, we can save a lot of lives by making believe we going to war, building tanks, building all the bombs, building everything we need, airplanes, going out in the middle Pacific, just dropping them, make them sink to the bottom, you know, come back and produce more, and no one will die. Okay? Sarah, did we satisfy you at least, or satisfy your questions?
Yes. That was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling Liberty
Thank
Talk
you.
Radio.
Good answers.
All right. Good night. All right. We have, you want to take another call here? Here we got another call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Call the 298. You're on the air.
This is Jim, Bixby, Oklahoma.
Jim from Bixby. How are you, Jim?
Good. How are you doing tonight?
Fine. Thank you for calling in.
And Andy, always enjoy your monthly calls with Joe. Glad that you're, at least for the time being, you guys are. Hopefully, we'll make this a regular event. I happened to catch a couple minutes of CNN today. I try to avoid mainstream news, but was in the lobby of a business, and I was kind of a captive audience. And Obama happened to say, you know, he's been looking for scapegoats with the national economy, and for a while he was, you know, blaming it on Bush and the past administration, which is understandable. Today he happened to say that the one reason why our economy is so stagnant and sluggish is because CEOs are hoarding cash. And I wanted to get your reaction to that comment, and then I have a quick follow-up question.
Which CEOs?
Well, yeah, I mean, he wasn't specific. Obviously, the ones that I assume he's speaking of, the probably, you know, primarily the Fortune 500 companies that are cash rich. But beyond that, you know, I don't think he was specific in any way.
Yeah, well, I know there's a lot of anger right now about the banking system. That's why I asked which CEOs. There's all these bailout dollars from you and I, basically, and our children and grandchildren, have you, and they've essentially sat on it, and the Federal Reserve incentivizes them to do so, paying them interest on their balances that are held at the Fed, and they've actually been so bold as to say, hey, we're going to create, and I think they actually pilot tested this about a month or two ago. The Fed wants to create a bank CD program where banks can deposit monies at the Fed. And basically, it's like you and I buying a CD. That's kind of an aside. So they've been hoarding it. But I know that there's a lot of people that are kind of getting after some of the bigger companies because they are cash rich. Most of it's borrowed, by the way. Very, very little of it's actually been achieved by, you know, actual earnings increases. If you look at most of the S&P 500, a lot of that money, there's a lot of debt there, too. But anyway, they do have cash, and they are kind of sitting on it, paying a pittance, really, in interest, and they're not hiring. And I think the reason they're not hiring is because they're looking at it like we are, and they're saying, well, why should I go? Where's the incentive for me to go and expand my business right now?
Right.
Where's the spending going to come from? Where is the consumer activity or what have you? Where's the industrial activity? Or, you know, maybe it's a big outfit like a Dow Chemical or a DuPont that makes housing products or some whatever. And they're saying, well, that market's in the toilet, so where exactly is the opportunity here, and why should I go out and expand operations? I think instead of blaming people, you know, these politicians ought to tackle the issue, you know, and it comes back to that again. You know, they want to blame people and have scapegoats instead of saying, well, why are they doing this?
Right.
And there's very good reasons.
Well, I agree. I think, you know, any, you know, whether it be a Microsoft or a DuPont, I mean, there is so much, to put it bluntly, uncertainty with our economy, that to make major investments could be highly risky and speculative, and a lot of it has to do with the uncertainty of increased taxes and regulations that the Feds are doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can tell you this much, Jim. I'm up here in the Northeast, and I have a really hard time finding anybody. And I talk to mostly small business, you know, small and medium sized people. I get emails from them, I have conversations, I have friends, whatever, and I can't find anybody that's, you know, ripping and tearing to go out and expand their operation. People are trying to figure out how to cut costs, how to squeeze more out of a nickel, and most of them are trying to figure out how to do it without laying off any more people. And that's the climate. That's the environment. So I think scapegoating them and saying, well, you know, these bosses, these company bosses, are the reason why the economy is sluggish. First of all, it's ridiculous because small business does most of the hiring in the country anyway. So to blame Fortune 500 CEOs is kind of misdirected to begin with.
Right. Right.
So there's a lot of things wrong with a statement like that. And I think, again, it comes back to we're just looking to blame somebody and we're really not concerned about the actual issue.
And of course, Obama would know so much about running a business. Right?
Well, I wouldn't let him. You know what? I'll be honest with you. I wouldn't let him. I wouldn't have let the guy before him or the guy before that run a lemonade stand.
Exactly.
Hey, Jim,
real quickly, I'll take your answer off the air. Joe and your last caller have already. It's hard to talk about the economy without referring to the global implications. As an investor, and I'm not asking for individual investment advice, but I'm intrigued by a lot of the other global economies. Some are doing rather well, some better than others. Do you have a favorite country or region from an investment point of view? If someone, myself or anyone, was to look at like country ETFs, are you most bullish about a particular country or region? And I'll. And if you would answer that and briefly share why, I'd appreciate it, and I'll take your answer off the air. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Jim.
That's
a good question that he brings up because there's a lot of people that really are looking outside America. And, you know, it's difficult because you have to look at a lot of different things when you look at countries. Obviously, you want to look at political stability. You want to look at, you know, their position in the world economy. My big keyword right now is sustainability, is what they're doing. Yeah, it might be working real good right now.
Right.
Is it sustainable?
Yep.
Is it something that's going to last into the long run? And there's a couple places, and oddly, I'm not real bullish on China. A lot of people go crazy over China. I am not crazy over China, and there's a lot of reasons for it. The smallest of which is that obviously their GDP is running very hot.
Right.
That's really not sustainable at this point. They're even trying to step on the brakes and cool it down a little bit. I like some of the other smaller countries that service the people in China with staple goods. That's something you can look into. And there's a number of countries in Asia that do that. You can look at Singapore. You can look in Hong Kong, and you can find opportunities there. China obviously has a huge population, and looking at companies that provide them with basic necessity type goods is a real solid place to start. I like Brazil. I like Brazil because they've got a bunch of resources down there. They have some oil resources. They have the forest down there, obviously. There's a lot of good things going on down there. Their currency has been very competitive, particularly against the dollar, which I know isn't saying much, but you've got that whole situation there in Brazil. I also like Canada. Canada's set up fairly well fiscally. A lot of people kind of bashed Canada because their treatment recently of some of the royalty trusts that they have up there, particularly in energy.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to be sorry they did that. But as far as fiscal situations go, Canada probably is a little bit better off than some of these other places as well. So there are things out there. There are locales and jurisdictions where you can find a bunch of opportunities. We cover a lot of those in more detail on the newsletter when we analyze opportunities. I've looked at a couple over the past 3 months and that service different areas, and I try to focus on basic businesses, Joe. I don't like to get into a lot of this frivolous consumer stuff. You know, I'm not caught up in this eye frenzy from an investor standpoint. You know, they're really cool gadgets, but is it sustainable? And I think the consumer here particularly has a lot of problems. Sure, Apple might be able to export some of them, but you look at Europe consumers, they're having to go austerity. They're having to go that route now. And a lot of the spending, has come from government spending in the past. So there's just a lot of things you have to look at. And I know that's probably jipping Jim on a real cohesive answer, but those are some thoughts that people could probably take into account when they're thinking about these different kinds of opportunities.
Okay. Andy, I'd like to just take a break for station identification. When we come back, I'd like to talk about is the employment paradigm shift. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased to have with us Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and we are talking about the economy. We'd love for you to call in with your questions or comments. You know, 646-652-4620. Let me repeat that. 646-652-4620. Now, I do get emails and people mention, well, I wanted to call in, but I felt, you know, uneasy about doing that or interrupting. Please, there's no such thing as a stupid question. We'd love for you to call and love to hear from you. So don't hesitate. 646-652-4620. Of course, our email address.
And let me second that. Please do interrupt us. I tend, once you wind me up, I tend to be like that little Energizer bunny. So it gives me a chance to kind of regroup a little bit. So please, if somebody's thinking about calling, they feel like they don't want to interrupt, go ahead, interrupt away.
Yeah, I do get that. They said, "Well, I would have called, but I didn't want to interrupt." And I go, "Well, geez, you know, but just, you know, we'll let us handle that part. You know, we'll beat up on you later." But if you do have a question and you're listening to this program through the archives or rebroadcast, you can send your comments to comments@libertytalkradio.com. That's comments@libertytalkradio.com. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the employment paradigm shift. And my wife is an audiologist, and she's not a small company. She's what they would consider a micro company, just a few employees. Someone called her, in fact, a doctor of audiology called her and said, "I just would like to have a part-time job, and I'd like to work for you." So my wife came home, and she says, "Geez, you know, I really never know what to ask, you know, when I employ, you know, when people come in." And, you know, she's an audiologist, you know, she's not an employment person, you know. So I said, "That's easy, honey. Just say, fine, I'd love for you to work for me. What will you do for us?" And she stopped in her tracks. She says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, they're coming to you, and they want a lot of money per hour. They want a lot of money an hour, big money, you know." I said, "Fine." Say, "Well, if they want, let's say, $45 an hour," I say, "you'd be more than happy to pay them $90 an hour, double that. What will they do? I mean, what will they bring in?" And I said, "Herein lies the big paradigm shift. A few years ago, it was an employee market. People were looking for employees. You fill out an application. Even if you made no sense, they'd hire you because they needed you. And they said, just put the guy to work. We need someone on the line. They'd take anybody." So it was an employee market. And it almost didn't make any difference if you had the right qualifications for the job. They were just happy someone applied for the job. Today, because the job market is so tight and because companies have to be so careful, when someone comes in, they say, "Fine, we'd love to hire you. How are you going to make this company any money?" Now, they might not ask that question, but that's the question that looms over everyone's head. What do you think about that, Anne? Do you think that paradigm shift is actually occurring, or am I hallucinating again?
No, I don't think you're hallucinating. I mean, we've obviously shifted from an employee-driven labor market to an employer-driven labor market. There's huge competition for jobs. A lot of it's demographic. Everybody talks about the baby boomers retiring out of the workforce and how it was going to put all this pressure on Social Security and Medicare and all of these types of things. I'd like to actually mention the downward pressure that the non-retirements of the baby boomers or the unretirements of the baby boomers are going to put on wages, just because so many of these people did retire. Say they retired in 2006 or 2007 and they were still in this housing paradigm, and they read that idiotic book, Retire on the House, that somebody wrote and kind of insinuated that you could just live off your house forever.
Right.
And all of a sudden their investments got shattered in 2008, and now they're trying to re-enter the workforce.
Right.
You know, Joe, I don't know if this is just me, or maybe you can tell me if I'm hallucinating on this one. Every time I go into a fast food restaurant, I see older people working behind the counter.
Absolutely.
And it's not just during the day either. It's in the evenings also.
Right.
And I've noticed that. And I've noticed, you know, it's not just that. It's, you know, other places like some of these home improvement places and different retail outlets. I'm seeing a lot of older folks working at these jobs. And I know that the unemployment rate for young people is at, you know, near all-time highs. And, you know, that kind of gets my wheels turning, and I start thinking, you know, boy, we not only have we changed paradigms, we've changed paradigms a couple of times, you know, where it's so hyper employer driven right now that, yeah, it's what are you going to do for me? What value are you going to add to my business?
Right.
I'm really apprehensive about hiring somebody. You better give me a really good reason why I should go out on a limb here and add you to my payroll.
Absolutely. You know, oh, let me tell you the rest of the story with this doctor of audiology. So my wife asked that question. She said, well, what could you do for this practice? The person looked at my wife and she said, well, I don't know. My wife says, when you find out, would you let me know? And she didn't hire him. I mean, and that's a true story. And this only happened about 4 or 5 days ago. I mean, we're not talking ancient history. And as far as looking at the demographics of the people working at the fast food places and whatever, I was at a Walmart a few weeks ago, and usually they have, you know, women who are working part-time there and whatever by the checkout counter. And there were three checkout counters in a row where there were older men checking out. And I've never seen that before. So it,
I think that's becoming a more and more common occurrence.
Yeah. And people, what I have been reading, they said they would love to have a job at Walmart at any price. They just want to work, and they can't find it. Now, that is scary.
Yeah.
That is really, really scary.
Well, you know, and I think, Joe, this goes back to a point that we made earlier. And, you know, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I think it's that important that people really, you know, you can't just turn on CNBC or CNN or any of these news networks on Jobs Friday. I call it Jobs Friday. That's when they release the unemployment situation. And get a true picture of what is going on. You can't do it. You know, they would lead you to believe, well, the unemployment rate's falling. Well, they don't tell you that record number of people are leaving the workforce.
That's right.
You know, they've given up. They're not even discouraged anymore. They're just, they've quit. They haven't looked for a job in 12 months. And, you know, as far as the Labor Department's concerned, once you haven't looked in 12 months, you just disappear. You don't count at all.
Right.
And that's just patent fraud.
Right.
You know, those people don't have jobs. They love jobs. They'd love to have a job. They'd work at Walmart or whatever. They can't get anything, and they become so they just leave the workforce.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, they don't count anymore.
Yeah.
What, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, and that counts. You know, that's how we're going to tabulate these statistics. I mean, that's, you know, where I come from, that's fraud.
Right. You know, and remember the old adage, what do you want me to do, work for McDonald's and flip burgers? You know, this is like, I would never do that. And now you find people who are highly educated that would do anything for that job. It's a totally,
yeah,
totally different world. You know, and this is seeping into our college institutions, and I'd like to get your take on this. At one time, you went to college, and you got this piece of paper, and this degree, and this degree was sort of like a free pass to a job. Today, that doesn't mean anything anymore. I mean, you can have the degree, and now people are going for their master's and their PhDs, and they're finding out that they still can't get a job because employers are saying, I don't care what the piece of paper says. I want to know what you can do for me. I would be more than happy to pay you $100 an hour rather than $7.25 an hour, but tell me how you're going to do that. And they can't. They
well,
just stop dead. And I think the universities are all going to – we're going to see a downward pressure on universities. People are going to stop going because they're saying – why spend all that time going to debt and then not still be able to get a job? I like your opinion on that.
Joe, I just sat down with somebody last week who went to college for 4 years, got what should have been a marketable degree. 10 years ago, it would have been a very marketable degree, and, you know, ran up a, you know, debt of 50,000, 60,000, whatever it was, and is working as, you know, in a restaurant as a waitress, and is happy to have the job.
Yeah.
And there's more and more and more of this. You know, when colleges were graduating their classes back here in May and June, there were all kinds of articles, even in the mainstream press, about, you know, what are the prospects for the class of 2010 when the class of 2009 is waiting tables?
Right.
You know, what's the sustainability of a society that thinks it's entitled to a college education, these institutions, you know, you hear the radio advertisements, the degree you deserve and all this other stuff. Everybody is entitled to go into debt $100,000, $125,000, $150,000 for a college education to wait tables. You know, you want to talk about sustainability. I mean, I would seriously, and I get emails, Joe, a lot from college students. You know, they're in their first, second year, whatever, and they're trying to figure out a major. You know, maybe they read an article or something like that, and they say, hey, you know, I'm gonna ask these people, you know, that write these articles what they think about college. And I always say, well, what's your major in? You know, and they'll say, well, you know, art history or, you know, general business or something like that. And I tell them, you really want to reconsider that because there's so many of you.
Absolutely.
And there's so few jobs. You know, what are the prospects of you getting a job? And when you have employers, you're saying, all right, you know, I've got to, by law, pay 5 cents an hour. Or they're talking about it again. I've got to pay this. Figure out how you're going to produce at least that for the employer.
That's
but they're
right.
not even going to hire you. That's the way
right.
the employers are thinking about things.
Absolutely,
now.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to pay you this amount. How are you going to bring at least that much into my business?
Yeah. And yeah, in fact, we had we went out to dinner with my son, one of my sons, one of my three. And with him was a friend of the family. She's a gal. And I didn't know. She had a master's of business administration. And I said, wow, I didn't know you had a... Wow, I was really impressed. I said, well, what are you going to do with that? And she gave me this blank look like, what do you mean? I'm going to get a job someday. I'll use it to get a job. I said, doing what? She hadn't the foggiest... I need the foggiest idea. And I said to myself, exactly what I've been preaching about. You say, people... you said the magic word. She now is entitled to a job because she has a master's degree. Everyone else doesn't count. And I didn't say anything to her. I thought to myself, she better understand that. She better be able to offer something. She has to be able to offer something. Listen, if you're making so much a year, I can improve your bottom line by so-and-so. And if you don't hire me, you're the loser. If she can't do that, she ain't going to work.
Exactly. And, you know, and I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, I got an MBA back in 2002. There's so many of them out there now. You can get them online. Every single college thinks this is the ticket to prosperity now. They have all these satellite campuses everywhere, and it's just infested. Everybody are, you know, these colleges are really, they have no foundation in any type of economics or marketing or finance or accounting or whatever. They've got, you know, very little experience in even deploying these types of programs. All of a sudden, they're offering an MBA, and it's distance learning or everything else. And I would never, if I was, you know, where I was 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I would never get one again. You know what I would do? I would go out and I'd get myself a degree in geology. I really would.
That's right. And you know what? That's what I would do. In fact, you and I picked the same field. Because it's specific. It's something where you can, I mean, you can go and do something and you have a specific talent, expertise.
Maybe metallurgy or something
right.
like that, but it would be something that's related to, you know, procuring some of these things that the world economy needs to continue operating. You know, the days of, you know, getting master's degrees or PhDs in, you know, Egyptian art, nothing against the Egyptians, but frankly, your art's not that important in the grand scheme of things, and there's very few jobs. You know, you've got these institutions that are taking $150,000 to give a kid a degree in some of this stuff. I mean, you know, just you have to look at, you know, everybody, well, find something you love doing and then go figure out a way to make money doing
right.
it. If you can't figure out a way to make money doing it, then don't do it.
That's right.
You've got to find something that you're going to be able to get a job in. And it's very competitive now. And I feel sorry for the kids that are in high school, the kids that are in college. They're competing against not only their own peers, they're competing against unemployed strata throughout all the different socioeconomic groups, demographic age groups. You've got baby boomers that have 40 years of experience coming out of retirement and giving their services away at cut rate prices. And these kids have loans, and now they don't even own the banks anymore. Now they owe the government, because
right.
the government just snagged all of that, you know, a few months ago. I mean, this is bad,
yeah.
Joe. This is bad, bad, bad.
Well, who? I mean, I would never have expected that a doctor so-and-so would call my wife and say, listen, I'll just almost do anything, just a few hours a week, and my wife says, thank you, but no thank you. I mean, that's a real kick in the pants. By the way, I'd like to change the the subject a little bit. In your last newsletter, The Sensible Investor, and folks, this is one reason why you really must subscribe, because he has a, I printed out, it's like 20 pages long, but it's in layman's language as to what is going on. And he breaks it up by segments. So he'll break it up into the energy sector, the general economy, Social Security in this case, and whatever. And he goes through all of the scenarios, folks. And you really get a better appreciation for what is going on and where we are going. So you really go to his website. I guess it's sutton-associates.net and subscribe to The Sensible Investor. I think it's very, very reasonable, folks. Do yourself a favor and do that. I've been doing it for years, and like I told you, you know, if something should happen to Andy, I'm going to exhume the body because I want to make sure I get my monthly issue. Now, in there, the first portion, you talked about Social Security. This is a laugh. I mean, this is so, you know, I think I'm losing my mind, because whenever I hear someone talk about Social Security, we are on a different planet. They had the head of the Social Security Administration interviewed, and they said, "Well, you're in the red. You have no money." She says, "Oh no, we are flush. We have plenty of money, enough money to about 2040." Now, the person interviewing didn't say, "You do? Where is that money?" Well, she doesn't have any money. I mean, the Social Security Administration has no money. They have IOUs from a bankrupt government. That's their security. And, you know, it's like saying, you know, the Penn Central Railroad, you know, owes me $1 million. I'm a millionaire. Well, they went broke. I mean, you know, and yet, what is it that we don't press these people and say, where is this money? In what form is it? Is it actual bills? Is it in precious metals? What is it in? You know, is it in stocks, bonds, or is it in government debt that obviously can't be paid? And they just let that whole thing slide, and they gave the impression that, oh, Social Security is in great shape. There's plenty of money all the way to 2004, where everybody who's thinking on the planet knows that the darn thing is totally broke and bankrupt as of today, or has been for a long time. And now it's running negative. And it's about 5 years, well, 7 years ahead of running negative. Now, I heard another statement that something like 18,000 people a day go on to Social Security, additional people go on Social Security. Where's this thing going, Andy?
I'm going to have a really bad memory for people. You remember Hank Paulson?
Yeah, oh, sure.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And Hank Paulson used to do this every time somebody would ask him about the dollar. He would always go into this like robotic monotone and say, a strong dollar is in the national interest. That was like his patent phrase.
Right.
And Sheila Bair, in charge of FDIC, her patent phrase was, every depositor dollar up to $250,000 is guaranteed, blah, blah, blah. Every time they're asked that, they come out with this standard answer, and it's almost verbatim every time. And Social Security, their patent moniker right now, or their, I call it a punchline, because you'd really have to be crazy to give it any credibility. Social Security has plenty of money and will be able to continue paying everybody and their brother and uncle and whatever at full benefit level until 2040. That is that's the
right.
Government's fee
right.
for Social Security. And that's why I despise the mainstream media, because they will never press them and say, show us the money. Where's the money? Well, you know what? It's all in Treasury debt. It's Treasury bonds. It's Treasury bills. It's government, you know, agency bonds, whatever you want to call it. It's not cash. It's not precious metals.
Right.
It isn't even stocks. It is debt.
Right.
They have a cookie jar, and it's stuffed full of IOUs from the U.S. government, because our delinquent Congress, our absentee leadership over the last 40 years, have raided it every single time they wanted to have a pet project, a pork barrel project, or whatever you call them.
Right.
They ripped it off and they stole it. And
right.
I don't know of another way to say it.
I know. You know what it's that saying? You know, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play? We have somebody else on the line here. Let's see what they have to say. Caller, you're on the air. Your name, please.
Yeah, hi. Hi, I'm Daniel. Daniel.
And I'm just I'm listening to Mr. Is it Mr. Sutton? Is it Mr. Sutton?
Yes.
Please call me Andy.
Andy. Okay. You know, when I felt I'm gonna, you know, I guess call in and give you my consents. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Hank Paulson and the strength of the dollar being a pillar of our economy. I mean, nothing. there can be no greater lie. I mean, ultimately, we are a nation of consumers. You know, we're not a nation of citizens anymore. You notice most people refer to Americans as the American consumer. I think that's a very common context today. And the reason for that ultimately is because the pillar of American influence essentially rests with its ability to export consumption. I mean, consumption is our number one resource, I would say. I mean, we consume, right? We have goods coming in from China. We have goods coming in from all over the place. And the more we can consume, the stronger we are, you know, seemingly internationally. However, you're entirely correct. I mean, if all we do is consume and we don't produce, then, you know, our GDP is going to be based on fiction. Yeah. It's going to be a fiat currency that's supported by a fiat accounting system. So I find it interesting. You mentioned Hank Paulson, but equally, what would you say if I might ask, if someone were to suggest that, well, Hank Paulson was thrown into an existing system and an existing problem, and you know you can't fault Paulson or the Bush administration and so forth for, you know, for all the evils that have happened to our economy in the last half decade or so, because ultimately it was a perfect storm. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say first, you know, it's a good point. I mean, Paulson was thrown into a situation just like Tim Geithner was thrown into a situation. And, you know, as far as responsibility for this, you know, the Bush administration had 8 years out of the 97 that the Fed has been in existence. And the problem is the Federal Reserve. It's, you know, these administrations and banking officials, I mean, they've perpetuated it. They've been absentee. They certainly haven't done anything to fix it. But when you really, if you want to really rip down to the core of the problem, it's the central bank. It is the issuance of fiat currency. It's the issuance of unbacked currency. And it just allows all kind of fiscal recklessness and monetary recklessness. And it can be done behind closed doors because the Fed's a private institution. It's unaccountable to the people. Yeah, you know, and they'll say, well, the president appoints the head of the Federal Reserve. Big whoop. Big whoop. The president... you know, appoints them, the Congress, you know, they Senate, they give them the confirmation. All right, so what? Most people are not even aware of what the Fed does. So it's very hard to get the populace around this idea of, you know, you heard this end the Fed kind of thing. And it's very good. We need to end the Fed. We need to abolish it. We need to prosecute the criminals that run it, because that's exactly what they are. They've stolen from the American people for almost 100 years now. And that's what needs to happen, but it's to get people to understand that, because it's very difficult to get people to understand what exactly this is. Most people still think that the dollar is backed by gold.
Well, you know, Andy, it's interesting that you say that, because I find that, yes, it's undoubtedly true that most people have absolutely no clue what the Fed is. In fact, most people believe that the term the Fed refers to the government. So most people are clueless. I agree with you. I think that at this day and age, you know, re-educating society is probably a hopeless cause. Idealistic, perhaps, but hopeless. there's just, you know, so much counter propaganda, and you know, anybody that says anything about the Fed or about the way the federal government is run fundamentally is automatically labeled a conspiracy theorist. You know, and I mean, it's the classic tale of, you know, discredit the author to discredit the message. You know, but that's not even the issue, because if you think about it, the Fed was enacted in 1912, and from 1912 until, I'd say probably mid-60s, maybe even late 70s, you know, about till about, I'd say, the peak of the Cold War, despite all their shenanigans, we didn't have the problems that we have today. I mean, like the, you know, the host said just earlier, and I find that remarkable, that we're crying about Social Security. Well, one, Social Security isn't there, and two, the engine that puts Social Security, when I say Social Security, I'm not talking about the enactment of the law, I'm talking about the fund behind it. The engine, which is the actual money that's being paid out today, was put into the fund by the baby boomers, and that engine is now defunct. we don't have the same contributors. Our standard of living is ridiculous. It's in the sky. It's unsustainable. So
sure.
I'm just wondering, you know, taking deflecting for a moment from the Federal Reserve, though I wholeheartedly agree with you. Yeah, the Fed is a government-sanctioned mafia. Yeah, I give you that. But you know, it's been around since 100 years, almost 100 years, 98 years, and we haven't had the problems. But look at what's happening now. What do you see happening in the next 5 or 10 years? And I'm not asking for doom and gloom. I'm asking for fact. What, in your opinion, if you were to project the economy 10 years down the line, what would your projection be?
Well, first of all, I want to point out that you're absolutely right about the Social Security mess, and our problems have accelerated, mostly due in part to the fact we went off gold totally in 1971, and that's when things really started to go crazy, and the debt curve started to really start to spin up. And now it's going parabolic, and it's tracing out a precise mathematical function, and it should not be really a surprise to anybody who's been paying attention. And Social Security is a symptom. Medicare is involved in there as well. There's many, many, many contributors. Where are we at in 5 years? Where are we at in 10 years? I don't see us philosophically addressing any of these issues. So I don't see any meaningful reforms towards mitigating any of this. So basically, I see a lot of kicking the can down the road, to use somebody else's moniker. You know, we'll try to stimulate here and there. We'll borrow more money. We'll try to scapegoat. We'll basically keep doing what we've been doing.
Band-aid economics.
Yeah. May I, gentlemen, may I interrupt? We have about a minute or a minute and a half left before we get zapped. But, excuse me, Andy. Daniel, may I ask, what part of the country are you calling from?
I'm actually calling you from Quebec. I'm in Canada.
Oh, Quebec. That's one of them. Yeah. If you would do me a favor, if you would please send me an email to comments@libertytalkradio.com and a mailing address and your T-shirt size, I'd love to send you a Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt. Okay, just wanted to say that.
That's great. I appreciate it.
Please,
we'll send you that.
Okay, please. And Andy, if you can wrap this up in about 1 minute or so, I'd appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm going to use that minute or so. I mean, I'm not going to plug the newsletter or the service. You've already kindly done that for me. I'm going to try and kick around his question here a little bit longer because it was a good one. And Joe, I get running, so just cut me off when I run out of time. kicking the can down the road for 5 or 10 years. You know, I've kind of come up with a saying recently: this thing is going to go until it doesn't. And I don't know what day that's going to happen. I don't know what year that's going to happen. You know, there's going to be some kind of a trigger event or maybe a series of trigger events, and the status quo is going to be altered and probably forever. And there's going to be, you know, pretty much a massive awakening in the fact that, hey, the party's over. And we've been trying to keep it going. We've been trying to fill the punch bowl. We've been trying to do quantitative easing or all these other fancy schmancy technical things that, you know, the media likes to talk about it, you know, because just the fact that it's a complicated term means it's got to work, right? So I see a lot of that. I see a lot of status quo until a day arrives, like kind of what happened in Greece and some of these other countries in Europe, which ironically you don't really hear much about anymore, but it's very much still going on. It goes until it doesn't, and when it doesn't, then it's going to change, and it's going to change dramatically, and it's going to be difficult, and people aren't going to have the opportunity to embrace it. They're going to have it jammed down their throats.
Randy, we've got to cut it off. I'm awfully sorry. I wish we could go another hour, believe me. Daniel, thank you very much for calling in and listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Andy, thank you so much for being our guest. We look forward to seeing you, from you again third week of September then, okay? And thank you so much for being here.
Joe, thank you for having me again. I'm looking forward to being back on Liberty Talk Radio.
Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Good night.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.
Oh, boy. This was a real very, very, very busy. This is the end of today's broadcast. We'd like to thank Grand Shakers Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, folks, there is no middle ground. Ron Paul has a sign at his desk that says, "Don't steal. The government hates competition." With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.